The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me on the program is Martin Armstrong. Armstrong became a very successful business forecaster with Armstrong Economics, or Princeton Economics, which had offices in Paris, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Sydney, employing more than 240 people around the world. In 1983, the Wall Street Journal cited Armstrong as its highest-paid advisor. He became one of the top currency analysts, and his work was requested by the Presidential Task Force, the Brady Commission, investigating the 1987 crash. Martin, I want to begin our discussion on economics, and one of the problems with a lot of economic consulting firms today is they are so far off the mark. A good example is this year, economists were predicting 3% economic growth. When that didn't happen in the first half of the year, they were talking about a second half recovery, which is looking rather weak. What distinguished your work at Princeton Economics, and what gave you the ability to make the accurate forecast that you did when you were at Princeton and are still doing today?
Well, I think largely the difference was that our clientele was international. And that really kind of forced me to look at everything through everybody else's eyes. And what you begin to see is that, unfortunately, in the United States, the predominant economic community tends to look at just the United States as if we're the only thing that really matters. And I think largely that's where they always end up failing. For example, the 87 crash, the reason we were really the only firm that was able to forecast that was simply because it's a fairly common sense thing. I mean, if you have sold all these assets, I mean, the Japanese bought, you know, even Rockefeller Center, all the bonds in the United States, et cetera, they were buying. And then you stand up, you form G5, which is now G20, but in 1985, and then you say, well, to ease the trade problems and create employment in the United States, we're going to force the dollar down by 40%. So they don't understand, because they only look at it from an American perspective. But if you bought a lot of assets in Mexico, and Mexico stands up and says, by the way, we're going to devalue the Mexican peso by 50% next week, don't you think you'd sell and get out of there? You know, that's the problem in America, is that we don't understand or respect so much the impact that we have globally. And the 87 crash took place because of foreigners were selling everything. And if you looked at the economic statistics, nothing happened. Interest rates didn't rise. There were no bad economic numbers, absolutely nothing. And that's what made it such a shock to everybody domestically. And that's when we got called in, and that the Brady Commission at the end said, well, we think, they didn't want to admit that the G5 caused it. At the end, they said, well, we think it had something to do with currency. And when you're getting into these currency swings of 30, 40% in a 2 or 3 year period, you're dramatically changing the way capital moves globally. And probably any of your listeners that have invested in emerging markets or in Europe, you know, whatever you've made on a particular stock in Europe, you've lost by the decline in the euro. So it doesn't much matter if I say, gee, look, I can make you $1 billion real quick in Zimbabwe, and they're going through hyperinflation, and it doesn't mean anything. So you have to really look at things from a global perspective, and that's been largely the problem in the United States, that it's too domestic in all its forecasting and everything else.
Your model predicted, once again, the top in the financial markets in February 2007, and then you also predicted the bottom. So once again, was it looking at the global macro picture that gave you that confidence? Because our guys over here completely missed it.
Yeah, you can't look at things just purely domestic at all anymore. We have a global economy. And if you look at the contagion that has taken place that began off of mortgages in the United States, I mean, it wiped out Iceland. It has created a world recession to the point that on October 15th, you have the demonstrations around the world on this, you know, Occupy Wall Street stuff. So we really have to understand it, that everybody's connected globally, and there's nothing that we can do that doesn't affect somebody else. And this is part of what you hear in criticisms coming from Russia and China about the U.S. dollar being reserve currency. Because if we increase our money supply to affect domestic rates, that is exported then, and they're suffering from inflationary pressures that are coming to their land as well. So everything is very much connected, and the politicians don't appreciate, I think, really how globally the economy has evolved. I testified before Congress in 1997, and they were asking, well, gee, how come no American companies got any of the contracts in China to build the Yellow River Dam? And I said, look, the United States and Japan are the only two countries in the world that tax worldwide income. I said, so a German company bidding on the same project to build over there is already 35% cheaper. Then the German citizen who decides they would like to go over there and work for a year, do so tax-free from Germany. Only U.S. and Japan tax worldwide income. And if you find a dime in a parking lot in London, they want their share. But, you know, that's the problem. We're not competitive. And in the United States, you can see it, like there's three states that don't charge income tax. And like Delaware doesn't charge sales tax. So a lot of people move from Pennsylvania to Delaware just to have their mail order business. I mean, people do move around because of these issues. And you have a lot of people that, a lot of companies that have left cities because of taxation. We really have to pay attention and be competitive on everything that we do.
You know, this recently caused the head of Coca-Cola to say that the United States has become one of the most inhospitable places to do business. So this gets back to your point in your testimony, because if we have more regulations, if we have more taxation, if we're taxing the money wherever it goes, it makes us less competitive, and now we're not just competing against Europeans, we're competing against the Chinese, we're competing against the Brazilians. So it is really a global world, and you would think, Martin, that members of Congress would begin to recognize that.
Well, unfortunately, they're not economists. Most of them aren't even business people. Most of them tend to be probably the dominant profession or lawyers, and they have this attitude that, well, they can pass a law and everybody has to comply. But that's not the case. You can pass a law and say 55 miles an hour and nobody can go above that. Doesn't mean people aren't going to do so. But I agree. I mean, we're always looking at more and more regulation. And the problem is that we have this economic decline, and then the natural response from some of them say, oh, well, it wasn't regulated enough. We had more than 10 agencies regulating the CDSs that collapsed. Not a single one did anything to prevent a single crisis in this country. We keep adding layers and layers and layers of regulation that simply do not work. I mean, the SEC hasn't prevented one economic recession, one economic decline. We have too many agencies, and that is the problem that created Homeland Security. Because they admitted that a lot of these agencies had information on 9/11. Even the people who were from the first attack on the World Trade Center had drew the World Trade Center on the walls of their jail cells with planes going into it a year before.
Mm.
They took pictures, all kinds of stuff, but nobody does anything. You have too many agencies, and so they created Homeland Security supposedly to sit on top of all these agencies to get the information. And we're just so overregulated. I mean, just have one agency to do this. Why do we need so many different ones, and they all contradict each other, and then they compete and won't share information? So we seem to defeat everything that we do, but the answer is always not improve what we have, always add another agency. And to the point we have so many people running around, it's crazy.
Yeah, we just added in the financial regulations bill a consumer protection agency. What are they going to do that's any different than the other agencies that are out there regulating the financial markets?
Absolutely nothing. And if you really look carefully, the issues that created the problem, which was the derivative CDSs, they still didn't regulate. So they regulate everything else around it, but they just don't do whatever is right at that point in time. And they made it worse because these instruments are now, they changed the accounting system. We adopted Japan. So we're not even marked to market anymore. Now it's basically they don't have to even report a loss until they take it. So you're seeing the result of that in Europe, where all of a sudden some banks are going down. And people were then saying, oh, my God, look at the portfolio that they had on these CDSs, but they don't legally even have to report it now. So it got worse, not better.
Let's talk about maybe one of the reasons why QE2 failed. I mean, the Fed announced last year QE2. It was supposed to stimulate the economy, bring down the unemployment rate. But what it did is it exported that money overseas. It forced a lot of those governments, especially in Asia that are pegged to the dollar, to print more money. Now they're dealing with higher inflation rates. And Martin, we're stuck today with a market that's exactly where it was when the Fed announced QE2. In your view, will they announce another QE3 or QE4 as some on Wall Street anticipate if the economy weakens?
Well, unfortunately, they feel they have to do something. But in all honesty, I think they do realize, at least the people that the Fed, that no matter what they do, they can't stop it. Because we are in a global economy, I mean, you take the QE2 idea that, okay, fine, you're going to buy 30-year bonds and you're going to take them in, and therefore, in theory, people will want long-term, there'll be a shortage of long-term debt, so therefore they'll lend more back to the mortgage market. Again, that shows the problem of this myopic view of the world. China said, well, gee, thank you very much, and they shortened their maturity by selling their 30-year bonds and moving, you know, down to 2-year notes or less. So the problem we have is that there's no way to stimulate the economy, because if they pump in the cash, there's no guarantee it just stays here. Be exported overnight. We don't know who owns what. The only thing we do know is that 40% of the interest on our national debt goes out to foreigners. So the old economic theories were a fixed exchange rate system and all these things after World War II, but it just doesn't exist anymore. And we really have to sit down and revise the entire world monetary system, because nobody knows what they're doing.
I want to go to the euro for a moment, and I want to have you comment on, I think it surprised a lot of people, the movement in the euro markets with their problem. People don't understand how capital is mobile today, and it can move. So as European problems accelerated, money moved out of the euro, capital flowed into the United States, strengthening the dollar, because we had a lot of dollar bearers at the beginning of the year. And in that process, not only did it strengthen the dollar, but it brought down interest rates. Now, a lot of people would credit that most of this came as a result of Fed policy, but isn't it more a movement of global capital, Martin?
Yeah, exactly. The same precise thing happened in 1931. Most people don't realize, because it's another one of the things they tended to leave out of the history books. But virtually all of Europe defaulted on its national debts in 1931. Britain went into a moratorium. They eventually came back and honored it. South America defaulted. China defaulted. You can go to an antique dealer and you'll find a lot of these bonds. They're very pretty, and they sell them very nicely framed up for people. But as that happened, the capital came here, and that's what pushed the dollar up to all-time record highs during the Depression. Now, politicians didn't understand what they were doing then either, and that's when they came out with Smoot-Hawley and said, oh, this is protectionism, and they were trying to force the dollar down back then as well. Eventually, you know, FDR did devalue the dollar and in 1934, and that kind of got things going up a little bit after that. But what we're seeing in Europe and what the Europeans didn't do properly, they thought they were creating a single currency. What they didn't do was they didn't create a single debt. So they left the national debts in each of the members. And what they did at that point in time is really they left, by doing that, you're creating a derivative that, okay, fine, the Deutschmark doesn't exist anymore or the Greek drachma, but if I short the Greek bond, it's effectively the same thing as if it were the currency. I can isolate just Greece and sell that. Now, what happens is that pressure has been pulling Europe apart, and they're not prepared to consolidate the debt to stop it, and they keep putting Band-Aids on to try and prevent it. But it's not going to happen. I mean, Europe is collapsing under this monetary idea that they had. And the way I can explain it in American terms, I mean, if you can imagine what chaos we would have if all 50 states were allowed to issue federal government debt. I mean, it would be an absolute free-for-all. And unfortunately, in Europe, there is no single European bond. Every country issues its own, and then the banks use those independent states. They take their debt and they use that for the reserves to say that the banking system is secure. Now, when you start taking Greece down and people start attacking the bonds of Spain and Italy and so on, what happens is now you're attacking the actual reserves of the bank. So now we have a banking crisis developed. So, I mean, Europe is just, the politicians won't do the right thing. And therefore, it's just turning into a real basket case.
Martin, does the euro survive? In other words, let's say they're forced through a financial crisis to create some kind of political union, because right now, as you pointed out, they have a monetary union without the political union to go along with it. So you have this disparate policies of countries issuing different bonds. Can they survive, or does this whole thing fall apart?
I seriously doubt under the current conditions that they would survive. And that is going to cause a lot of economic turmoil. And that kind of brings us back to where the domestic analysts here will get it wrong again, because as that capital comes fleeing from the craziness in Europe, that will only push the dollar up even higher. And right now you have Japan is also an economic basket case. The yen is going up to record highs because right now people are pulling money back to Japan because they need it so desperately. But once that's over, then it will flip and the capital will start coming back out again. And that will then drive also the dollar back up. And then our politicians here will get mad about, you know, the implications on trade, et cetera. Our trade deficit will get worse. Unemployment will rise. They'll blame it on that. And then we'll be back to the same old stuff that we were in the 30s. But Europe has to, there's no real domestic confidence to support a political union. And everybody's blaming everybody else at this point. And probably the majority of the opinion in Europe against any kind of a political union. And you're seeing the massive amount of people protesting. I mean, there were absolutely like 10,000 people out there in Spain about this Occupy Wall Street. We're getting the youth in a lot of these countries, particularly in Southern Europe, unemployment rates are like 30%, in some cases up to 50. I mean, you're looking at major political disruptions here, and where we go doesn't look too good as long as the politicians refuse to sit down and actually look at what's happening. but they're all just trying to get hold on to their power.
Now, when we go back and translate that here, as the dollar moves up, as it's doing now, meaning that it's going to make our exports more expensive, and then you have politicians here calling for currency manipulation by other countries, not realizing the global economics. Yet, Martin, we have here in the U.S. more calls for more regulation, more taxation, more government intervention. It's amazing to see this transpire. It's like nobody has ever gone through and read a history of what we did in the Great Depression that turned a recession into a depression. About the only thing it seems like Mr. Bernanke learned from that was to print more money. But in a global economy, when he prints money, it comes back and boomerangs here.
Yeah, I mean, we're still living under a lot of the old Marxist agenda in many ways. And it sounds nice. I mean, you see these people saying we're the 99%. But what they really don't understand is that if you confiscate all the assets of the top 1%, what are you going to accomplish? Will it do anything? It won't even balance the budget. I mean, that's not our real problem. I mean, you can keep raising the taxes all you want, but we have deficits far beyond that. And we're not going to solve the problem that way. We really have to do a serious reform. And if you take, for example, what the Tea Party has been saying, it sounds nice, balanced budget, okay. But we have debt that is continuing to increase. And so what will happen is that the cost of interest to keep carrying this debt that we never pay off is going to continue to escalate. Eventually, that would reach 100% of total expenditure. So you can have a balanced budget, and the debt crowds out everything else from Medicare, you know, all the way to unemployment benefits. There won't be any of that left. So a balanced budget, we're beyond that too. We really have to do a serious monetary and economic reform here. And the government has been doing this since World War II. They borrow year after year after year, and there's just never any intention of paying anything back. If you go to a bookstore, all right, you can go look for basically the World Almanac, little paperback type thing. And in the beginning, look there, they have tables, all the data on the national debt. And year after year, they'll list how much you paid in interest. If you add up the interest expenditure between 1986 and 2006, you'll see about 80% of the increase in the national debt was all interest.
Mm.
So we're not getting anything for this. 40% of that money is going out of the country. So it's just astonishing to me that you can cut every program you want, but the national debt is off the table. You can't negotiate it. You can't. I mean, we have to create a new monetary system. We just have to do so. I mean, the debt is going to take over absolutely everything to the point we won't have any kind of expenditures for anything. I had called the doctor for my mother, and they said they're no longer taking Medicare patients because they're anticipating cuts coming through in January. So you can have these nice programs, but they keep chopping away at them because of the rise in the national debt cost. You know, they can say, oh, well, we're going to tax the rich. Okay, fine, go ahead. Take everything they have. It won't stop the continual growth in the national debt. I mean, it's like the pink bunny that is on the Energizer, you know, commercial. It's just going to keep on going. So unless we sit down and start really seriously saying, look, we have to revise everything and let's look at this, there's not much that we really have to look forward to other than sheer economic chaos.
Is it going to take a crisis, Martin, as we saw take place in the 30s, which unfortunately led to world war, especially with tariffs and the modern equivalent of currency wars that we're seeing take place today? Is it going to take a crisis before they act? Because they seem to want to continue the same policies. You're hearing, okay, we'll be okay if we just tax the rich. They need to pay their fair share. But as you pointed out, you could tax the rich, take away their money. You're still going to have a budget deficit, and we're still sending interest overseas. In fact, I read a figure that we're paying China in interest on the debt it owes. We're paying them enough interest to pay for their entire military expenditures.
Sure. I mean, it's incredible that they always want to blame corporations and say, oh, they ship jobs overseas, and that's why we're losing jobs. If you look at the amount of interest that we're paying as leaving this country, it's far more than what we're losing in trade. And it's a shame, because we just have a lot of rhetoric all the time, rather than just looking at the simple truth. And it seems to be a lot of dogma, I think, that prevents people from even looking at things, or they just don't want to. I'm not sure. But politicians are, I mean, I've worked with a lot, and it's very frustrating, because you can tell them, listen, you know, the train's coming down the street, and it's going to, if you don't step out of the way, you know, you're going to get killed. They go, well, you know, I don't say anything right now. And they just won't act until there is a crisis. That, to them, it's kind of like, you know, a guy comes up to you and says, listen, I just saved your life. And you look at him and you say, yeah, what'd you do? Well, you see that car at the top of the hill? Somebody didn't put the brake on. It started rolling down. It would have hit you. So I jumped in the car, put the brake on, so I saved your life. The guy doesn't see it, so he goes, yeah, how do I know you're not just lying? And that's the way the politicians look at it, that they can't win an election by saying, vote for me because I stopped you from losing your house. And they would much rather that you're under the gun, that you're losing your house, and then say, vote for me and I'll prevent it. But they won't act in advance. So, unfortunately, that's, I think, what's wrong with our political system. And the two words, political economy, should have been divorced the first moment they met. But, unfortunately, that's what we have to live with. And so they will not act until the crisis happens. And then they want to have their big hearings, and then they want to investigate, and then they always want to criminally charge somebody. But they've had investigations for every stock market crash since 1907. They've never found this mythical short player that pushed everything down. But it's great grandstanding, you know. And, I mean, all the yelling and screaming that they did over the derivatives, but they still didn't regulate them. They still didn't stop the CDSs from being issued. They did nothing. They regulated other things and added more agencies and more government jobs, but they actually did not do anything to prevent what was happening. And to tell you the truth, the reason they will not do so is because the banks that they were looking at are the ones that are what is called primary dealers. Primary dealer is the one that sells the government debt for them. So they're never going to charge criminally any of those banks, because they've become kind of like the financial crack dealer. They're not going to give them up. If they really wanted to help the economy, they should have shaved 25% off of the mortgages and basically funded it that way. That would have prevented all these massive foreclosures. And the problem with the foreclosure is, you know, some people say, oh, that's liberal, you're taking... But the problem is that all that property now comes out onto the market. By that coming onto the market, even if you have a house and you're current on your mortgage payments, now your property has declined in value because of everything else that's being sold. It's all interconnected. And so the worst recession ever is always a real estate recession, because people will spend money as long as they feel they have equity in their home. If they feel that they no longer have that equity in their home for retirement or whatever, they don't spend money. So a real estate recession is the worst of all, and that's what we have.
I want to move on to the topic of gold. We've been talking about how the global markets work. We've got capital flows coming into the United States that's driving the dollar up, and we probably have the best-looking house in a bad neighborhood. Let's talk about gold for a minute, because there's some out there that propose a silly notion that if we had a gold standard, we wouldn't have these problems. even though when we had a gold standard, governments continued to print money. The 1920s in the U.S. is a good example of that. How does gold fit in here?
Well, gold is a good historical hedge, not against inflation. That's nonsense as well. It's really a hedge against political instability. And that's what we're really into at this stage in the game. It's a sovereign debt crisis that's developing on a global scale. Gold in 1980 was $875. And even if you look at foreign cars, a Porsche was about $50,000 back then. It's now about $110 or so. So with gold being at $1,600 to $1,900 in that area, it's not overly priced. It's about on par with everything else that has risen. I mean, a Cadillac in 1995 was top of the line, was about $45,000, and now they're also about $100,000 or so. So we're not looking at something that is abnormally overpriced compared to everything else. Gold will eventually run up dramatically as the crisis in the global sovereignty debt issue more or less percolates up all the way around the world. But, and then you have the possibility of gold going up to like $5,000 or something like that. But the main difference with gold is that gold standards are not, I think they're just sales pitches for people that are trying to sell gold. Gold is not a hedge against inflation, and it's not, a gold standard is not going to do anything. We've been there and done that, really. I mean, we had a gold standard. And politicians would not raise the price of $35 because they would have to admit that they printed more than they were supposed to. So they kept it at $35 until 1971, and Nixon could no longer hold it. We would have lost all the gold to Europe. So he closed the gold window. It was the only thing he really could do at the time. So the idea of creating any kind of a standard, doesn't matter what it's with, it does not really, has never historically worked. And that maneuver has been tried even going back to times of Babylon. There are tables there that they had produced which have survived, listing all the commodities and what are the prices to be regulated to be sold at. So, I mean, this idea has been around a long time, but nothing is going to force the politicians to suddenly be magnanimous or find religion. They're always going to spend more. They're always going to say, vote for me, and I'll give you this, that, and the other thing, and I'll let somebody else pay for it later on. And that's the kind of a system we have. So gold is more of a independent vote, so to speak. That the main advantage of gold is that it's at least movable. Those fleeing Germany and Russia found that out. You can have a very nice house, but you can't take it with you. So gold has always historically been more of a store of wealth. It's not money. And that has always been some of these, you know, people that keep trying to sell it for some reason or other, make up these stories that are just not true. It is a store of value. It will rise in value against government uncertainty. And that's really what we're looking at.
Final question, if I may, Martin. As you look forward over the next 12 months, what do your models tell you about the economy and the markets?
Well, basically, I think we're headed into, going into the end of 2015 is where we're going to get another big, I think, economic crisis. I think that's probably where the sovereign debt crisis comes to a head. But between now and then, unfortunately, it just looks like more and more we're in a bull market for volatility. I think that initially we can still see gold consolidate a little bit. I wouldn't expect it to take off dramatically yet. Largely because a lot of people are still confused, trying to figure out what's going to happen in Europe. There are people that, you know, want to be optimistic about it. But the old story of the difference between optimist and pessimist is that the two of them are on the top of the Sears Tower and they get blown over. And the pessimist immediately starts praying, oh my God, I'm going to die. And the optimist, as he's passing the fourth floor, says, well, so far so good. So I think that is pretty much sums up our problem. There are people that just don't want to admit that there are economic problems, and unfortunately, refusing to address them early on is kind of like cancer. I mean, you can cure it if you deal with it. But if you don't deal with it and you wait to the very last end, it's too late. So I think we're in a bull market for volatility, and that's what we're looking at, particularly over the next 2 years.
All right. Well, listen, Martin, as we close, you're having a World Economic Conference in Philadelphia. Tell our listeners about it. It's going to be held December 3rd and 4th.
Yes, we're doing the first day is really more for people that are more professional traders. That's kind of an analytical training session, more or less. The second day is our World Economic Conference, which I always enjoy because we have people flying in from absolutely everywhere in the world. They're coming from India, Southeast Asia, Japan, Australia, South Africa, all of Europe. I mean, we have participants coming from everywhere. And the main thing that I think a good international audience does, it allows you to see the global economy right there in the room. You can see the capital flows as opposed to just these myopic domestic type things. And that's why I enjoy them. That's why we call them our World Economic Conference, because basically everybody comes from all over the world. And we cover the whole world, not just the United States. And basically show the interconnectivity of what's going to happen over the next few years and why.
And if our listeners would like to find out more about that conference and make reservations, can they just go to your website, Martin?
Yes, they can go to armstrongeconomics.com, or they can go to martinarmstrong.org, and they'll find, you know, details about the conference there that they can look at. And they can send an email to armstrongeconomics@hotmail.com. And they'll be glad to forward details of that. And I don't know what seating is left yet, but I'm sure somebody will take care of it for.
All right. We've been speaking with Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics. You can find out more about Martin's work, his blog, by going to his website, armstrongeconomics.com. Martin, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. I hope you'll come back and talk to us once again.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.